The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And greetings from a relatively cool and rainy England at the moment. We're getting ready for school to start in just a couple of weeks here at Edstone. The last chance to make a few changes and upgrades and things around here. We've got the floor up in half of our radio studio. Our producer's in there trying not to put his foot through the ceiling while keeping everything running, but the show must go on. Well, on today's show, I want to ask the question, is Donald Trump saving Britain? What effect is he having on Brexit? Now, that wouldn't be a popular idea here in the UK. I think the idea of being saved by any US president, let alone President Trump, is not something that people would readily agree to. It's probably not something I would readily agree to. But when you look at the evidence, well, I mean, there's a whole lot of evidence on Britain being hugely impacted by the election of President Trump. We'll put ourselves in a bit of a time machine today. Take a look into an alternative reality in which Hillary Clinton won the US election. And we'll take a bit of a look at what Brexit would have looked like. We can play quite a few clips for you from Hillary Clinton, from former President Barack Obama. They made it very clear where they stand on Brexit, where they stand on Britain. And we can look at what this situation would have looked like with them in charge. You can also have a quick look at the effect this would have had on the Jewish state in the Middle East and Israel, and see how this really ties in to some really important forecasts we've been making at the Trumpet, some really important news events. So that coming up shortly. First, I just want to bring a couple of news stories to you today. Now, I'm sure you remember that a UK ship was taken and seized by Iran. I guess that was coming up to a couple of weeks ago now. And the UK, we turned to Europe for help. We asked the EU to form a joint patrol to keep the Strait of Hormuz safe and to help protect our ships and everybody's, all the international ships going through the Strait of Hormuz from Iran. And over the last few days, this has provoked quite a lot of discussion in Germany, with some more remarkable news on that coming in yesterday. So within Germany, there are a lot that are keen for Germany to get involved in this naval protection mission, for Germany to send naval vessels to come patrol the Straits of Hormuz near Iran. You've got Norbert Röttingen. He's a senior figure in Angela Merkel's party. And, well, he said that Germany has a moral duty to get involved. He says, our prosperity lives on free shipping. And we have to make clear that we stand alongside our British friends, partners, and allies who are affected. Wolfgang Ischinger, he's a former German ambassador to the US, and he now heads the Munich Security Conference. He also, on Sunday, called for Germany to get more involved. He said, he said hardly any other country is as dependent on the freedom of international shipping as export champions Germany. And so because of this, he said, Germany can't just watch what's going on over in Iran from the sidelines. The last week, on Thursday, the new defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, she suggested that Germany might take part in the mission. And then just coming in yesterday, the U.S., the United States, has now formally requested that Germany join the naval security mission. So the U.S. ambassador said, we formally asked Germany to join France and the U.K. to help secure the Straits of Hormuz and combat Iranian aggression. So currently the U.S. is is providing some security there. Britain, I think, now has a couple of warships there. But the US is joining Britain. So now both Britain and the US, they're turning to Germany and saying, well, can you help us secure the Straits of Hormuz, which is a really interesting development. Mr. Callum Wood had an article a week or two ago. Well, it was just a few days ago, I think. Maybe it was beginning of last week. Yeah, it must have been beginning of last week on the website, on our website, thetrumpet.com. And, you know, he pointed to one of the key prophecies that we're looking for in the Middle East, that we're watching for this confrontation that Daniel 11 talks about between a king of the north and the king of the south. And you can read, you know, there's a lot of history in Daniel 11, but you can read clearly as you get into to around verse 40. That passage talks about at the time of the end. So a time much later than Daniel, there's going to be this clash between a king of the north and the king of the south. And you can read our free booklet, The King of the South. We'd be more than happy to send that to you. But that proves how Iran and Iranian-led radical Islam is the king of the south. A German-led Europe is the king of the north. So we're watching for that prophecy. And he points out in that article that Daniel 11 and verse 40 talks about this king of the north coming against the king of the south, coming against Iran with chariots and horsemen and many ships. Or in the Moffat, it says that, well, when the end arrives, the king of the south shall butt at him and the king of the north shall storm at him like a whirlwind with chariots and cavalry and a large fleet, invading his lands and flooding into them. So it's really interesting to see now Germany getting potentially called up to join a naval mission outside Iran. Is this the start of that large fleet? And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has drawn attention to that word whirlwind before, and that one word tells us a lot about the way Europe and the way Germany will confront Iran. They'll come at Iran like a whirlwind. They'll surround Iran, come at them from multiple directions. He goes into what the original Hebrew of that word whirlwind means. And again, I think that's in our booklet, The King of the South. There's a lot of depth in just all of these verses detailing this coming confrontation. And so he talked about how, well, you can look at where Germany is deploying forces, where they're building military bases, where they're building local alliances, where they're selling arms to different regional militaries. They're getting ready to surround Iran. They're preparing for that. They're getting an early presence surrounding in all of these different areas surrounding Iran. So with the prospect of this fleet coming up, well, are you going to see them preparing to come at Iran with a large fleet? Getting some ships, just probably at this point, just a few ships into the region, then establishing some naval bases and naval links to nations in that region. Are we going to see a movement towards that? And we're certainly seeing Britain and America pushing Iran in that direction. Now, Mr. Flurry has also drawn attention. He did this in the, I think it was the January Trumpet print edition, that often Germany doesn't act too aggressively unless there's a strong leader in place. So maybe they're not ready to start getting that fleet in place. But we could see that, and it's really interesting to see the United States pushing Iran in that direction. Also, some other news I thought I'd draw your attention to. Within Germany, they're still, and talking of that strong leader, there's still lots of tension in Germany, lots of tension over the migrant crisis. You're seeing now an outbreak of just a different sort of migrant violence. It was Monday in Germany, in Frankfurt. A man came and he pushed an 8-year-old boy and his mother in front of a train at Frankfurt's main railway station. Now, the mother was able to roll to safety, but the boy, the 8-year-old, couldn't. And he was hit by the train and he was killed. The man went on to try and push somebody else off the platform. There was no apparent connection between him and his victim. He just seemed to be up there trying to push random people into the path of a train. There was a massive police deployment, the police said, with 6 platforms closed for several hours to try and sort this out, to try and catch this man. And they did catch him. He's not said why he did it, but it's come out that the man was from Eritrea. He was an immigrant to Germany. And he carried out this attack. Now, he hasn't said that it's a terrorist attack yet or anything. Oh, we don't know whether that was behind it. But you have just a really shocking, abominable attack carried out by a migrant in Germany. And that is, you're just rising up a lot of these passions again. You had the week before, a Bosnian migrant. He threw a 34-year-old woman to her death in front of a train. And, well, last year there was a migrant from India. He tried to kill a 5-year-old boy by grabbing him from his family and jump off a train, kind of a murder-suicide. And again, I think in that case, there was no connection between him and the boy. So you're seeing a lot of an uptick in people talking about this. And it's kind of, I mean, it is a particularly scary problem. I mean, how do you solve something like this? I mean, first you had, say, terrorists and attacks coming from people with guns and bombs. And so, we can use gun control to try and get rid of the guns. And we can do things to try and limit explosive materials. Then you have had attacks using knives and rental cars and rental trucks, which is harder to stop. And then now, people just using their bare hands to shove people in front of trains. I mean, if somebody wants to kill people and they're in your country, they'll find a way of doing it. And so this is really stirring up the migrant crisis once again in Germany. In just a really disturbing story. And we'll see that keep pushing politics in Germany. Again, going back to some of those same prophecies in the Book of Daniel, one of the big things we're watching for is the rise of a strong man. And so the way you see that this anxiety building, this dissatisfaction with the politicians that have allowed this, and it's mainstream politicians from all sides that have been opening the doors to migrants, you can really see that, and you can really see the way that that's already building a strong anger within Germany at mainstream politicians and this really strong desire for something different. Well, and I guess I probably shouldn't spend too much longer just going over some of the news events. It's the other event that caught a lot of attention was the Democratic debate that took place yesterday. Just as usual, lots of very left-wing ideas, socialist ideas, lots of calls for heavy spending, lots of people competing with each other to see who could be the more far left. I think this time there were one or two voices that were speaking up and saying, well, are we sure we can afford all this? How are we going to pay for all of these things that we're promising? But those were the candidates that pretty much nobody has heard of. One of them, I think, was polling on under 1%, and all the other candidates there just piled on him, and he got kind of attacked by all of the big beasts for daring to ask the question. Well, how can we pay for this? We shouldn't be asking that. They're saying we shouldn't be so negative. I guess they'll be promising flying ponies and jetpacks then if we shouldn't be negative. All right, well, we'll take a quick break, and then when we get back, we can get into my main subject of today. We'll take a look at that alternative reality of, well, what would Britain look like? What would Brexit look like if it were Hillary Clinton in the White House?
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings?
What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
This is KPCG FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Hello, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. Well, as promised, I want to talk a little bit about, well, what would it look like if Hillary Clinton had won the election? But I want to focus not on the United States, but on the UK. What would the UK look like if it were President Hillary Clinton that we were dealing with over Brexit? And there's an important reason for doing this, and it ties into some really important prophecies. But if you look at Britain's new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, so much of his strategy now to help with Brexit, to get this done, revolves around the United States. He's penciled in plans to meet with Mr. Trump for three times before the Brexit deadline on October 31st. His administration wants to get wants to schedule some quality time in with Mr. Trump before August. A trade deal with the United States, that's one of his government's top priorities. And this whole relationship that he has now with President Trump, that really strengthens his negotiating position within the EU. You know, he can turn to Europe and say, well, we don't need a deal with you. We're best friends with one of the most largest, powerful economies on earth. We're getting a trade deal done with them. And we're moving forwards. We're moving forwards with them now. But as I said, how different would it look with President Hillary Clinton? We'll look a bit more about those ties with President Trump in a minute. But there's lots of this on record, and I'll have to play some clips that really make kind of this scenario real. And here's one of Ms. Clinton's most direct comments on Brexit. This is her talking to Queen's University in Belfast long after the Brexit vote. So here's her thoughts on Brexit.
Now, I make no excuse for being against Brexit from the start. I thought it was a bad idea before the referendum, and I think it's an even worse idea now. You know, it may well go down as one of the greatest and most unnecessary self-inflicted wounds of modern history.
So she's obviously not pro-Brexit at all. She's thoroughly in the Remain camp. In 2017, she told the Sunday Times that Brexit supporters voted against modern Britain in the EU, believing that this somehow would be good for their small village. It made no sense. So, you know, she's basically there talking about Britain as being, or pro-Brexit is, as kind of just being the small-minded, ignorant, backwards-looking, primitive people. That's her view on Brexit. And she's saying, you know, she's saying all of this after 17.4 million voters voted to leave the European Union. She made it very clear that she is on the EU side, not the UK, or not at least the pro-Brexiteers when it comes to Brexit. Here's another clip of her. This is her at Swansea University receiving an honorary degree in October 2017, talking about her view on the EU. This is clip two.
So there are reports of children being worried, feeling uncertain, even unsafe, trying to make sense of their places in the world. The Children's Commissioners for England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland have already raised concerns that children's interests are getting short shrift in the Brexit process. Now, I personally continue to believe in the value of the European Union, and more broadly, of a Europe that is whole, free, and at peace. No small accomplishment. And Britain has always been a linchpin of that vision. What's missing in both of our countries at the moment, it seems to me,
Well, that's the end of that clip. But basically, you know, she's saying that to her, the EU is a force for good, a force for peace in the world. She kind of views, she has this, you know, this really rosy view of the European Union. She thinks it's the European Union that has brought peace to Europe rather than, say, NATO actually defending Europe from the Soviet Union and making it so that Europe doesn't have to build their own armies. So, yeah, when it comes to Brexit or the EU, she is pro-EU. And we really saw what this looked like in practice when US President Barack Obama was in the White House. You know, he was actually traveling around to the UK in the run-up to the Brexit vote, just a few weeks really ahead of that, basically trying to put his weight behind Britain staying in the European Union. He was pushing Britain in that direction. Here's one of his, a clip from one of his speeches where he was in the UK ahead of that vote. This is clip four.
The United States wants a strong United Kingdom as a partner. And the United Kingdom is at its best when it's helping to lead a strong Europe. It leverages UK power to be part of the European Union.
So Britain's at its best when we're part of the EU. That's what Mr. Obama was saying, and you know what he wanted. And then he had this, you know, this very famous back of the queue comment when he was at that trip. This is, I have clip five in my notes. Probably I meant clip, whichever one we haven't played. Yeah, there we go. Clip six.
Maybe some point down the line, there might be a UK-US trade agreement, but it's not going to happen anytime soon because our focus is in negotiating with a big bloc, the European Union, to get a trade agreement done. And UK is going to be in the back of the queue.
The back of the queue. That's, you know, we're not going to support Britain over Brexit. And you can really see why when you look into the whole way of thinking of this whole movement, not just Mr. Obama and Ms. Clinton. You know, leftists in the US and this whole movement, they love the EU. They love its system of rules by experts with power centralized in one super bureaucracy. That's the way they would want to do things. That's the way they want to go. I think if they could, I don't think anyone in the US would stand for it. There's no way they could ever get it through the US system. But if they could, I think they'd love to bring the US into the EU. That's the way they want to do things. You know, rule by experts, centralized bureaucracy, minimal power for citizens, elections not really kind of upsetting things every few months, every few years. And that whole idea of, okay, well, can we get a bunch of professors, say, a bunch of civil servants who've studied this all their lives, and let's put them in charge because they know better than ordinary people and then voters. You know, they know that global warming is happening, for example, they would say. And you look at ordinary voters, and well, they're just ignorant. You've got too many people that believe, quote-unquote, fake news, that don't believe it's happening. What we need is to put the experts in charge. And of course, if you don't believe in global warming, then by definition, you're not an expert, even if your qualifications would ordinarily put you in that category. So you can see why they're so pro-EU. It is right in with the way that they think. So right now, a President Hillary Clinton, if she were in the White House, she wouldn't be there offering lucrative trade deals to Prime Minister Boris Johnson or any prime minister. You know, she would be on Europe's side. She would be trying to help Europe force Britain to accept a deal with the EU that humiliates it, that makes Britain this kind of all but conquered supplicant, just like the withdrawal agreement does. You know, she would be telling Britain, you know, actually, you better accept that withdrawal agreement that the EU is offering that hands over all of this power to Brussels and doesn't really give you any, this kind of Brexit in name only. And she would be telling the rest of other powers, you know, don't follow Britain's example. It was a mistake. We love the EU. You shouldn't have left the EU. Britain shouldn't have left the EU. And we're going to make it as painful to Britain as possible because we want to discourage other people from following the EU. I mean, that's exactly what you get by looking at her speeches. I think when you look back at when Britain voted to leave the EU in 2016, almost everyone believed that a Hillary Clinton presidency was inevitable. And at that time, Mr. Obama, he had a famously or infamously frosty relationship with the UK. He kicked the Winston Churchill bust out of the White House. Mr. Obama, well, he said, we don't have a stronger friend and closer ally than France. He said that German Chancellor Angela Merkel was his closest international partner. But meanwhile, under his presidency, a congressional think tank unveiled a secret memo that said the UK may not be viewed as centrally relevant to the United States in all of the issues and relations considered a priority to the US agenda. So, while the special relationship, no, that doesn't exist anymore, but France is our best friend and strongest ally, and Angela Merkel is our closest partner. You know, he was right in line with those European Union leaders. And obviously Hillary Clinton, who'd served as his Secretary of State, as his foreign minister, basically, she was right on board with that. She wasn't in that position towards the end of the presidency, but the first term, she thought exactly the same way when it came to Europe and Britain. And we had something just... that's what everyone thought we were getting. When Britain voted to leave the EU in 2016, that's the reaction it seemed like we were going to get from the White House. And instead, we got something totally different. And we can compare just quickly the two reactions of President Trump and Hillary Clinton when they heard about Brexit. Mr. Trump, he was immediately supportive. This is his reaction when he was in Scotland the day after the Brexit vote came through. This is clip 7.
People want to take their country back. They want to have independence in a sense. They want to be able to have a country again. So I think you're going to have this happen more and more. I really believe that. And I think it's happening in the United States.
You know, he said that I think there's a lot of parallels between the two. He also said, well, I love to see people take their country back. He called Brexit a great thing. You know, there was no question where he stood. And he was pro-Brexit all the way in the run-up. But then Hillary Clinton, she was very different. We can hear her take in the immediate aftermath of Brexit. I think I've got my notes in a bit of a muddle, but I think this is clip 4 for Hillary Clinton, again, in the immediate aftermath of that Brexit vote.
No one should be confused about America's commitment to Europe. Not an autocrat in the Kremlin, not a presidential candidate on a Scottish golf course.
That's right. We support Europe. And she rebuked this presidential candidate on a Scottish golf course. That was where Donald Trump was giving his speech. She rebuked him, saying, no, America is on the EU side, not Britain's side, and a presidential candidate that supports Brexit, well, no, he's mistaken. No, he's confused. And nobody should be confused about that. Clip 3 is another quote, I believe, from that same speech. Again, this is her kind of instinctive reaction to Brexit the day or two after it happened. We can play that now.
A lot of Americans woke up on Friday to alarming headlines from across the Atlantic. And they are wondering what this decision in Britain means for us. Now, we are resilient, and we will bounce back from this and from all of the other shocks that are in the system.
So, to her, well, we need to be resilient, and it's an alarming story. We woke up, they were alarmed by headlines. It's something bad that's just happened. And that was, I don't necessarily think that's like a considered reaction from her. That's just her instinctive reaction. Alarming headlines. Brexit equals bad news. So we've got something really different. And so then as the last 2 years have unveiled with President Trump in the White House and not a President Hillary Clinton, well, we've just seen such a different reaction than we would have gotten. You know, we've got a president in there who is encouraging Britain every step of the way, who's trying to help Britain. I mean, we'll play a clip. This is one from President Trump was visiting the UK, standing next to Theresa May. And this is him again talking about Brexit there. This is clip 9.
I think Brexit's going to be a wonderful thing for your country. I think when it irons out, you're going to have your own identity and you're going to have the people that you want in your country, and you're going to be able to make free trade deals without having somebody watching you and what you're doing. And I had a very bad experience. I had something when I was in my other world. I have something in another country, and getting the approvals from Europe was very, very tough. Getting the approvals from the country was fast, easy, and efficient. Getting the approvals from the group, I call them the consortium, was very, very tough. But I thought Brexit, I think it'll go down that it will end up being a fantastic thing for the United Kingdom. I think in the end, it will be a tremendous asset, not a tremendous liability. Okay?
So he wasn't alarmed by Brexit at all. To him, well, it was a fantastic thing. Great news. And, you know, listening to that all these years later, my reaction is just, you know, he gets it. He understands why people voted to leave the European Union. I don't think Prime Minister May ever got it. It was just, you know, she just didn't really understand. I think to her credit, she kind of went in there at the start and kind of with the view, okay, well, the majority of people have voted to leave the European Union. We need to give them what they want. But I don't think she ever understood why. Whereas for President Trump, it was almost just instinctive. He understood. He thought exactly that way on Brexit, the same way that the pro-Brexiteers thought and think. And so he's just been right on board the whole time. And he's even been supporting exactly the kind of Brexit that Prime Minister Boris Johnson wants. So Boris Johnson, he was originally Britain's foreign minister, and he ended up quitting Theresa May's government because he didn't like the way that she was doing Brexit. And he voted against the withdrawal agreement 2 times. I think he might have switched the third time, but at least for 2 times, he voted against Theresa May's withdrawal agreement, this deal. That wasn't the kind of Brexit that he wanted. And it's the same with President Trump. Here's what he said about Boris Johnson's, or about Theresa May's deal after that was unveiled. This is clip 8.
Sounds like a great deal for the EU, and I think we have to do this. I think we have to take a look at seriously whether or not the UK is allowed to trade, because, you know, right now, if you look at the deal, they may not be able to trade with us. And that wouldn't be a good thing. I don't think they meant that. I don't think that the Prime Minister meant that, and hopefully she'll be able to do something about that. But right now, as the deal stands, they may not be able to trade with the U.S. And I don't think they want that at all. That would be a very big negative for the deal.
So again, you can see he's right away, you know, this is a great deal for the EU. It's terrible for Britain. But you still see that positive, supportive tone in that, where he criticized the deal, but he didn't really come down and criticize the UK and take offense at it. He said, well, I don't think they meant it to work out this way. But really exactly the same approach on Brexit that we have with Boris Johnson. And as I said at the start, this is really helping the UK. I think ideally Mr. Johnson would like to leave the EU with some kind of deal. He wants to make Britain its own proper sovereign state again, like we've heard from some of those clips. He wants to find a way to keep trade flowing smoothly with the EU, though, to the benefit of both. And so he would like some kind of a deal just to help keeping these trade flowings going. Now, President Trump's offer of a trade deal, well, that really helps him enormously. You know, 'cause without it, well, Britain would look like this desperate power, this desperate supplicant with no good trading options except for going back to the EU. And so when they come to the EU and say, well, can we formalize our trade relationship? Well, you know, Europe could well have gambled that Britain would pay a high price, even surrender its sovereignty, in order to gain concessions against from Brussels, because they'd look desperate. Now, the EU might still take that gamble and try and force Britain to accept or to hand over its sovereignty, but that's much less likely now. A Britain with all of these other options, with a best friend in the White House, is a Britain in a much more powerful bargaining position. And then even just think about where we are just as a nation right now. I mean, would Boris Johnson be prime minister right now if there wasn't Donald Trump in the White House? And I think that's something that's really interesting to think about. I mean, what would have happened if Theresa May came back with her deal and the president of the United States was Hillary Clinton and she said, yes, this is a great deal. Congratulations, Miss May, for negotiating such a wonderful withdrawal agreement that really keeps the UK's relationship with Europe strong and stable and contributes to peace everywhere. If she was up there making those speeches, and then also maybe giving some warnings to Britain and saying, well, if you reject this deal, you're not getting any help from us. If you reject this deal, we're not going to give you a trade deal. We won't deal with you. In fact, maybe we'll put some tariffs on you. I think it's pretty likely that the UK would have, and the politicians that have never really been all that, in general, aren't pro-Brexit, I think that those politicians very probably would have surrendered to the EU's deal. They would have accepted Ms. May's disastrous deal, and that would be it. It would be over now. We would be under the European Union's thumb. We'd be out of the EU, but we'd still be accepting all of their laws and all of those downsides of the deal that we've gone into many times. And the EU would have had Northern Ireland there to pry away from Britain as kind of a punishment if Britain ever tried to move away from that position. That's probably where we would be if there were a Prime Minister or President Hillary Clinton. And then even if Ms. May's deal had been shot down, well, would Conservative MPs and party members, would they have had the confidence to elect someone like Boris Johnson? If there weren't President Trump right there offering support, offering friendship, even really endorsing Boris Johnson. I mean, when he came to the UK, while Prime Minister May was still Prime Minister, he talked about how, you know, he made it very clear that he was on Boris Johnson's side, that he was his preferred candidate for Prime Minister. So getting Britain out of the EU without the EU kind of vengefully smashing our economy, I still don't think that's necessarily going to be easy. But without President Trump, maybe that would have been impossible. And like I said, this is really important prophetically. Last week when I was on this show, I focused on Bible prophecies about a modern day Jeroboam. So 2 Kings verse 14 and 27, it describes how the ancient kingdom of Israel was about to be destroyed, but it said God saved them by the hand of Jeroboam. And while other prophecies indicate that God is going to save modern Israel, mainly Britain, America, and Israel in the Middle East, through a modern type of King Jeroboam II. And you can study that in detail in Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry's May-June 2016 article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. And if you haven't read that, please do read that from our website, thetrumpet.com, because that is really critical background on this subject, showing you why this history of Jeroboam II is relevant for today. But writing on this in the August Trumpet print edition, Mr. Flurry wrote, those people, these radical leftists, were getting control of the government. And talking about the US, he wrote, justice in the land was destroyed. Rule of law was twisted and perverted. People were losing faith in the government. If this trend had continued, it would have meant the end of our republic. And then he wrote, but God was not ready for that. He was going to save America along with Britain and the Jewish nation. However, this would only be temporary unless they deeply repent. There's no evidence this is going to happen. So God was going to save not just the United States through this modern Jeroboam II, through this President Trump, but Britain and Israel as well. He said this even earlier, actually. You can go back. We'll play a clip now. This is a May 2018 clip from the Key of David program.
And that can be proved as well. Verse 27, and the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. He saved Israel through Jeroboam, a type of Jeroboam in this end time. And remember, Israel is really not the nation in the Middle East. They're one of the nations of Israel, but the prophetic Israel in this end time is America and the British peoples. That's important to remember. But notice God said here that it was a bitter time in Israel. There were many curses and there was nobody to help Israel. And so would you believe what you see today in the presidential administration is really the power of God saving Israel temporarily? Can you believe that? And I'll show you more about it in Amos 7, because the focus is really right there in a prophecy we've been giving you for years. And we also have a booklet of Amos that we'll offer you, which will help you understand that.
So, I mean, if you listen to what he said, though, you know, Jeroboam II would save Israel. And who's Israel? Well, as he said in that program, well, it's Britain and America. And that was all the way back in 2008, before the withdrawal agreement, before so much of what I've talked about on this show. But you can really see how that has happened. And as I said, you can see it in Israel as well. I think if you look at what a President Hillary Clinton would have been like with Israel, you see exactly the same thing. If Hillary Clinton, or Ms. Clinton, she was really pro the Iran deal. Again, that whole movement of her and Mr. Obama and everyone, they were all right on board with this. She tweeted in opposition to Mr. Trump pulling out of it. She wrote, as I said, after the Iran deal was reached, it was not perfect, but it achieved its fundamental mission of blocking every pathway for Iran to get a bomb, she wrote. So far, the administration has consciously chosen a dangerous path, leading to a risky future. But diplomacy is still the only way for the administration to climb out of the hole that they've dug. So, Iran deal, she said, blocked every path for Iran to get a bomb, which is just untrue on so many levels. I mean, even if Iran were to stick to this deal, it doesn't block their path from getting a bomb. It delays them for the next 10 years. But then there's so many ways. I mean, Iran has lied and cheated on just about every agreement they've ever signed. And this agreement didn't provide any way for people to really verify and check that Iran was keeping the agreement. So it certainly didn't block Iran's path to get a bomb. It didn't block Iran's path to get a bomb in 10 years. It didn't block Iran to work, just to kind of keep working in the background on a bomb in the much more nearer sense. She also said when the agreement was signed, she said, I support this agreement because I believe it is the most effective path of all the alternatives available to the U.S. and our partners to preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. She said that we should applaud President Obama, Secretary Kerry, and Secretary Monitz for getting this done and proceeding with wisdom and strength in enforcing this deal to the fullest and in meeting the broader Iranian challenge. So it's crystal clear under a President Hillary Clinton, the Iran deal would still be in place. Now, even the way things are right now, Iran poses a huge threat to Israel. Now, Hezbollah, backed and funded by Iran, has somewhere in the region of 150,000 rockets in Lebanon aimed at Israel. But at least Iran is under some pressure at the moment. President Trump's been working with the Saudis and others to confront Iran. He's canceled the nuke deal. He's put on sanctions on Iran. You know, under President Clinton, how much richer would Iran be right now? You know, billions and billions richer. And then where would that money be going? Well, it would be going to all of their terrorist proxies. How much more powerful would those terrorist proxies be? How much more pressure would Israel be? What would Hamas be doing and the Islamic Jihad groups in the Gaza Strip? What would Hezbollah be doing? Would some of these countries like Egypt, how stable would they be with some of these militant groups, you know, with Iran just having cash to spare on these militant groups? I mean, you really see the focus Iran puts on funding these groups, because when they're forced to cut back, they cut back on everything else first, apart from these groups. They really try and preserve their funding. And so you can guarantee a lot of this extra money would be going right to these groups. So, yeah, is President Trump helping to save Israel from Iran and radical Islam? Is President Trump helping to, or is he saving Britain in Brexit? Well, and we're going to stick with and look at exactly what the Bible says, no. There is a kind of an important distinction on this. But you look at these prophecies and you can ask, well, is God using President Trump to save Britain and save Israel? Well, that really looks like what we're happening there. That's the point that 2 Kings made. It wasn't that Jeroboam II was a really moral man or a great man or anything like that. I mean, I'm sure God used somebody with a lot of ability, but it was God was the one that was doing the saving. And you look at this and you see, well, yeah, it really does look like God is using President Trump not just to save America, but Britain and Israel as well. Now, it's important to note that this rescue, this saving, is only temporary. God still prophesies that Britain and America will be punished unless they repent and turn to him. And we see no sign of either nation doing that. But this reprieve, this temporary saving, the punishment, and everything that comes after, it all comes from God's love. So you look at Bible prophecy, you see God is going to punish our nations. But he is carefully measuring that punishment. He wants our people to repent. And so he wants to make sure that they have time to hear his warning, time to act on it. And so he's saving our nations temporarily to make sure that that happens. Then if they don't change, if they don't respond to that warning, well, then they will be punished for their own good. But that punishment is going to enable our people to receive, and the whole world, to receive wonderful, wonderful blessings. And so I think it's really fascinating to look at events around the world right now, because you just see so much evidence of a loving God who has plans for Britain, for America, for the whole world. The Bible talks about God kind of measuring this destruction. He's absolutely in control. And now he's allowing time for this message to go out, and there's a reprieve. But then at the same time, you can see so many of these events leading towards, say, Europe unifying, Iran still rising in power, and these other nations now lining up in a position to punish Britain and America if they don't repent. Now, if you're not familiar with this plan that we really do see on display, I'd urge you to read our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That book, with millions of copies distributed, it would be considered a bestseller, except we don't sell it, we give it away. But that book explains the causes of all of these world events and shows the loving God behind them. Which, like I said, once you understand some of these prophecies, you see that loving God behind these bits of news all the time. So if you've not read that book, please do go to our website, thetrumpet.com, and order that book. Now, I want to move on to a different, another segment. I don't think I have time to put a break in here, so you can put in, I don't know, a mental break. But when I was talking about this reprieve, this Israel being saved temporarily, in last week's show, I talked about how it's being saved so that God can do a work. And we have an opportunity to maximize this short span of time, this reprieve, to support that work. And it's a wonderful opportunity. And I want to talk about one way that we can deal with that. And Mr. Flurry on yesterday's show, he was talking about leadership, learning leadership from learning history. Leaders are readers. So I want to take a few minutes to try and do that now. And I want to talk about an individual that I'd never heard of. I imagine many of you won't have heard of. And his name is Andrew Higgins. I read about him when doing some research and some reading for the D-Day program I gave a few months back. And in his book on D-Day, Stephen Ambrose tells this really interesting story about Andrew Higgins. So he talks about the first time that he met General Eisenhower in 1964. He was a historian, so he's interviewing General Eisenhower. And you know, he was going to go and meet for him. At the end of this meeting anyway, Eisenhower said, well, you're from New Orleans. Andrew Higgins is from New Orleans. Did you ever know him? And Stephen Ambrose said, no, I didn't. And Eisenhower, he said, that's too bad. He is the man who won the war for us. Andrew Higgins, the man who won the war for us. What did Andrew Higgins do that General Eisenhower, the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe, would say, oh, he won the war for us? Was he the man that came up with the brilliant strategy that they used to defeat Adolf Hitler? Was he a really heroic soldier, inspiring his men on with just tremendous courage? Was he someone who came up with, say, a super weapon to take out the Nazis? Well, no, he was none of those things. He wasn't in a position to be any of those things. Instead, he is a man who did a job that nobody else really wanted to do with all his might, that worked really hard on this job. And it's a wonderful illustration, I think, of Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10 that says, whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Now, one of the big factors in World War II that influenced the course of the whole war was a lack of landing craft. So why was D-Day in 1944 and not 1943? One of the big reasons was a lack of landing craft. People would come up with all of these different plans. And again and again and again, it was like, oh, we can't do that. We don't have the landing craft. Because it takes a specialized craft. You need to go from a big ship to the beach. The big ships, they can't go right up on the beach where soldiers can get off. They're just too deep for that. But nobody really wanted to do the job of making these landing craft. The Navy were much more interested in making battleships and aircraft carriers and these kind of big, glamorous boats. They didn't want to do landing craft was beneath them. That was for the Army. But Higgins really approached this with a passion. Now, the administration, the U.S. leadership, they really had to force the Navy to get these landing craft built at all. But even at this point, they didn't want to work with Andrew Higgins. Andrew Higgins, was a small businessman out from New Orleans. And if they were going to be forced to build landing craft, well, they were going to work with the big, established companies. Again, the more kind of glamorous companies. Higgins was a small-time boat builder. Didn't want to deal with it. But he had a design that he felt would really work. And he had to really bang some doors down to get people to listen to him, to get people to accept his design. And it finally got through because it was just so much better than all of the other ones. And he really wouldn't, he kept forcing it. He wouldn't give up. And the soldiers really preferred his design versus all of the other competition, other people. And then even with building, he went about it with a passion. He really worked hard. He really tried to motivate his workers. He saw himself not as just some kind of lowly boat builder that didn't really impact the war. He really urged everybody on. He had a sign over one of his assembly lines: "The man who relaxes is helping the Axis." He had a sign up in the bathrooms that said, "Come on in, brother. Take it easy. Every minute you loaf here helps us plenty." And that was, it was kind of like Hitler and Mussolini saying that. And he did a job nobody else wanted to do with a real passion. Now, in this short time that we've got in this work to do, we need everybody helping, contributing to get it done. And I don't think there are jobs out there that nobody wants to do, the same way nobody really wanted to build these boats. But there are jobs that we could look down on, like, say, small landing boats as maybe not important or not glamorous, that are actually critical. I don't really have time to turn there, but Romans 15 and verse 30, for example, talks about laboring in prayer. Paul writes there saying, work with me in prayer, strive with me in prayer. It's easy. It could be easy to dismiss something like praying for the workers, a small job, as something not important, as, well, I can't really help much. All I can do is pray. But it's critical. God wants people helping this work, and everybody can help in a way that makes a huge difference. And maybe you are a regular listener, but kind of sitting on the sidelines thinking, well, what really do I have to contribute? I'm not necessarily the greatest health. I don't have all of this to give. I can't do, say, any of any jobs that I consider glamorous. Well, Higgins could have looked at this and thought, well, I can't be a soldier. I'm not really in a position to be an infantryman. Instead, he worked really hard where he was and where he was going. And we can learn from that. We can, as leaders and readers, we can learn from that history. Well, that's about all I have time for. Thanks for listening here on KPCG at 101.3 on the FM dial. Please do keep sending us your feedback here at td@kpcg.fm.